Thank you, John. That glowing introduction prevents me from starting out by slashing at you, so I'll start with Lipset. In my view, this session is entirely unnecessary, and its place on the program shows that. As Tony Harrigan, who comes of a distinguished theatrical line, could tell you, in the old vaudeville days, next to closing was the star act, and closing was pretty much a matter of acrobats, jugglers, or dogs. Quite possibly those dogs that Alan Wallace told us at lunch today we were going to, represented before you right here. However, since I was suckered into this by Lipset, who was correctly described by John as a solicitor, I will give it my best try. Perhaps it would be of some use, not in order to pave the way for those of you who hunger to dip your sweaty little hands into John Olin's Foundation coffers, but rather to indicate how someone recently come to this work, myself, and John Olin as someone who has recently dedicated his foundation to this work, sees the mission as recently as January of this year. By way of preface to that, let me say only that I was drafted into this work from my legitimate career as Vice President for Employee Relations of the Olin Corporation by Mr. Olin a couple of years ago, at which time, like most lawyers, having never studied any economics, I had to learn some. And I have been occupied in doing that and in trying to carry out this brief mandate which he gave me at that time. He said, I would like to devote a considerable part of my fortune, and that's the word he used, bless his heart, to the preservation, if it's possible, of the system which made its accumulation possible in less than two lifetimes, my father's and mine. And I want you to help me. Up to that point, his private foundation had been very wide-ranging and heterogeneous, reflecting the enormous range of interests of an 80-year-old man who had been both an industrialist and an inventor and a sportsman and a philanthropist and a loyal alumnus of Cornell. And so I set about reshaping the foundation. As of January of this year, our trustees approved this set of this statement of our objectives. I will not read it all. I'll just read a part of it. It's not going to contain anything that will shock or surprise or even enlighten any of you particularly, but I think it may be of use to know how one foundation views its mission. Our general objective is to make a significant contribution to the overall effort to reestablish free private enterprise with its economic principles and its philosophical underpinnings as the dominant orthodoxy of the American political economy. Based on the principle that ideas have consequences, as so effectively exploited by the Fabians in Great Britain and the left liberal coalition in the United States, our efforts will be toward encouraging quality scholarship aimed at reversing the long trend toward an interventionist, socialist, collectivist polity and a return to the founding principle of limited government. Our prime objective is to encourage both education and communication which exposits, defends, and propagates ideas embodying principles of limited government, individual responsibility, free market economics, and the philosophy of the free society. In short, our efforts are aimed at altering the worldview of significant numbers in our society especially students, but also, it is hoped, communicators and other opinion molders, maybe even teachers, from a view which assumes the desirability of and even works toward more government and less freedom, to a view which predicates the opposite. As I say, our trustees adopted that. Now, our guidelines proceeded to set forth several categories to which our limited resources. It's not a big foundation, even as foundations on our side go, so we necessarily have to be fairly rigorous and selective in the areas in which we concentrate our resources in order to get some effect and avoid the sort of wasteful dispersion. I have six categories and one miscellaneous. Number one is postdoctoral and policy studies. Number two is undergraduate and graduate. Number three is secondary education. Perhaps I should go back, if I may, read them again and give you the percent of last year's giving which was allocated to each of these areas. Allocated not a priori, but this is how it came out after we gave to those causes to which we did give. Under one, postdoctoral and policy studies, 30%. Graduate and undergraduate, 33 1/3%. So right there, you've got something pretty close to 2/3. Secondary education, to which we give relatively little, simply because it's an enormous job and we haven't the resources to begin to tackle it adequately. So that's 2.3%. Communications, 24.6%. The largest hunk of which you saw a sample of, courtesy of Mr. Chittister last night. Labor, the labor power problem, as Reed Larson is fighting it and others are fighting it, and Mr. Olin and I have been fighting it. Indeed, I got into this work, I suspect, because he knew me in my role as Olin's labor relations guy, and we formed a relationship on that basis. As you can see, it produced absolutely no qualifications as a foundation administrator, and I demonstrate that every day. Number six is public interest law, the kind of public interest law which, at a minimum, opposes the kind that Ralph Nader has trademarked, and at its best has a true, carefully evaluated view of the public interest. That was 2.2%. And finally, in miscellaneous causes, 4.3%. I'll be glad to answer questions, provided they're not confidential, at the end of the session. Now let me move to a different topic. Many of you are aware of the fact that Irving Kristol cherished for several years the idea of forming a series of mini-foundations. I think the idea was born out of avarice. Irving discovered one time that corporations were giving away somewhat over $1 billion a year, most of it, as we all know, either unproductively or counterproductively, to image-building causes as seen by the public relations department of a given corporation. And Irving thought, why not us? It was his idea that it was, since he had heard a number of chief executives indicate that they'd like to feel that their foundations were doing a better job of giving money to the right people and the right institutions, that perhaps there would be welcomed some kind of institution which would help corporate foundations with that task. That idea never really got going, but it gave rise to discussions which resulted in the foundation I'm about to describe to you. Those discussions, plus a growing awareness that there are, in addition to business corporations, which whose executives, at least, really don't know what to do or how to go about looking for the proper places to put their charity, the at a number of private foundations, some quite small, some not so small, who, however, are without staff, are without that competent and sophisticated staff that John mentioned in the quote from Alan Wallace, who need help and would welcome help in seeking out, appraising, evaluating the kinds of things that they ought to be giving their money to. And so the idea was born to establish a foundation which would serve those purposes, a kind of service organization, though with a modest grant-making function. And it is in process of being born. For purposes of credibility, both on the business and academic side, it is precisely divided between the business world and the academic world. That is to say, there is no single chairman. There are two co-chairmen. One is Bill Simon, the other is Ronald Berman. Similarly, the vice chairmen are co-vice chairmen, and once again, one from the scholarly world, Irving Kristol, the other from the business world, or at least in this particular role, Jeremiah Milbank. And so, on down, eight more scholars, eight more businessmen. I prefer not to give the names of those who are either who have accepted, because I'm not sure altogether that everyone who has been asked has accepted to date, and I'd rather not embarrass anybody. At any rate, that's what it will be. They will be scholars of unimpeachable repute, thus reassuring the academic world, and also providing a capability for finding where those funds are needed. Where is that crucial $10,000 grant needed that will produce that dissertation or that book which will serve the cause far more than a great many more thousands less carefully targeted? The incorporating papers, this will be a 501c3 organization. It's unglamorous title, and we had a lot of trouble with the title, is the Institute for Educational Affairs. The problem, obvious to all of you, I'm sure, was to select a name. I hasten to add, we failed. So it was to select a name which would be meaningful to the people to whom Simon and his business colleagues were making a pitch for funds, but not so meaningful to the left, which still owns most of the pulpits, that we would get shot down before we ever got started flying. And hence the sort of, as Samuel Hoffenstein said of a volume of his poetry, poems carefully phrased so as to offend nobody. That's about the criterion that we had in selecting the title of this organization. The papers have been filed. It will be incorporated in New York State. The IRS letter will be applied for. We expect to be in business on the basis of an interim IRS letter by summer, and one hopes before. That's the good news. The bad news you've already heard from Alan Wallace and Stephen Hassler last night and the other panels. As Justice Powell said so long ago, the hour is late. What he didn't say is something a plaintiff said in a divorce suit I heard about recently. He applied for a divorce, and in the preliminary testimony, he was asked how long he'd been married to this woman, and he said 40 years, and the judge said, 40 years? You've been married for 40 years, and you want to divorce this woman now? Why, for heaven's sake? He said, enough is enough.